Okay, if we can begin. There's a bill on the agenda, and apparently just a few minutes ago, Senator Scheid requested that her bill, House File 3034, be pulled from the agenda, so we've done that. So we'll start out with Senate File 2647, Senator Lynch.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. We're here with Senate File 2647. And I would just like to begin. I'll just give you a little bit of brief background. With the exception of the year 2001, and that was largely due to the events of September 11th, 2007 was the deadliest year for law enforcement in this country since 1989. In 2007, shooting deaths involving police officers increased from 52 to 69, a 33% increase. And this bill provides that whoever intentionally takes possession of a defensive device being carried by a police officer is guilty of a crime and may be sentenced with a felony conviction. And it further expands the definition of defensive device. In October of 2007, the front page of USA Today, I think, best illustrated the impetus behind this bill. And the headline was, "As Slayings of Cops Rise, a New Brutality Surfaces." I'd like to also just thank the co-authors of this bill, Senator Metzen, Senator Foley, Senator Ingebretson. And I think that this is, in times of limited resources, this is a way that we can further support our law enforcement officers who put their lives on the line for us each day. In terms of a fiscal impact, we had a fiscal note prepared by the Department of Revenue. Specifically looked across five agencies: public safety, corrections, sentencing guidelines commission, Supreme Court, public defense board, and that resulted in a fiscal note of zero. And with me today, I have Bill Gillespie, who would like to make some additional comments.
Okay, Mr. Gillespie.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Bill Gillespie. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. We represent over 8,000 line police officers across the state. This bill is a compilation of resolutions brought to the MPPOA annual convention. It passed unanimously by the 150 delegates that were in attendance. In 2005, the last year in which there is complete reports available from the Minnesota Uniform Crime Report published by the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, there were 230 Minnesota police officers assaulted in the line of duty, or about 3% of the officers employed. 100 officers reported some type of personal injury from this event. In 2006, the last year that there is complete reports available from the United States Department of Justice Uniform Crime Report, there were 58,634 officers assaulted, or about 12% of the officers employed in the United States. 15,704 reported some type of personal injury from this event. The study entitled "Ground Fighting: Assaults on Police Officers" by Dr. Daryl L. Ross of East Carolina University, Caliber Press, reviewed all of the reported assaults of police officers in 2006. The study reports that 21% of the attacks involved an attempt to disarm the officer. 5% of the time, the assailant gained control of the officer's weaponry, and in 30% of those events, the officer failed to survive. A study conducted by the Federal Bureau of Investigation and published by the United States Department of Justice in August of 2006, "Violent Encounters, a Study of Felonious Assaults on Our Nation's Law Enforcement Officers," suggests that on average, 8% of police officers killed in the line of duty are disarmed and murdered with their own weaponry. Of the 594 officers killed in the line of duty over an 8-year span, 46 officers were killed with their duty weapons. 11 states and Canada presently have specific statutes that mirror the proposed legislation. And applying the statistical evidence presented in the earlier mentioned studies, the estimated bed space in Minnesota prisons for violation is minimal. And in closing my remarks, I would ask that your indulgence just for a moment and ask for your support for this bill and to move the bill out onto the Senate floor for with a recommendation to pass. I would be happy to stand for any questions.
Questions from the committee. The committee should be aware that the fiscal note on this bill is zero, and Mr. Mossman tells me that Mr. Turner indicated that apparently there was some discussion that the bill didn't necessarily need to be in finance. Usually when we have bills that have a potential bed impact on prison space, we try to bring them into the Finance Committee to determine the nature of the bed impact and the cost attendant with that. In this instance, I think the fiscal note suggests maybe an additional 5 to 10 offenders being sentenced each year, probably with minimal bed impact. So kind of borderline in terms of finance issues. Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a question. I see the existing law. It's up to 5 years imprisonment and $10,000 fine, and that's for disarming a police officer by taking or attempting to take an officer's firearm. And then the new law in this bill expands from the firearm to firearms, dangerous weapon, tear gas component, an electronic incapacitation device. And I understand all of those because they're very similar to a firearm. The one I have a question about is, are a club or baton? And then the crime is described as whoever intentionally takes possession of a defensive device, which is that list that's in Subdivision 1. And I'm questioning why a club or baton is included in that and what would constitute taking that. If the baton or club was being used, say, for crowd control, and an individual put their hands up to protect themselves from a blow from a club or a baton and ended up with the baton or club in their hands, you know, and the police officer's hands slipped off that baton, would that be subject them to a felony?
Mr. Gillespie.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fredrickson, that would be a jury fact or a fact for the judge to determine whether or not what the intent was in that.
Yes.
The matter of the purely taking the club from the police officer, yes, that would be a provision that would be included in this law.
Further questions? Senator Foley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say, Senator Fredrickson, that that's a common occurrence that they will be standing there and they'll grab the nightstick or the tear gas or some less severe type of thing, and then lose that in the course of subduing the offender.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up, I think what I'm hearing from Senator Fredrickson's question is if someone took possession of it as a form of self-defense, even if they were, you know, being subdued by a police officer, would that be considered intentional? Is that
right.
What you're asking? Would that be considered an intentionally taking possession of it? I mean, I think that's beyond a jury question, perhaps. It might be something that we should know or define.
Mr. Gillespie.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, it would be a provision of this statute if they took the weapon into their possession. Okay, that's very clear. It's still a matter of fact for the jury or for the judge at sentencing time to take a determination what they intended to do with that weapon. But again, I wouldn't try to deceive you and tell you that it's not part of that provision. We want that. We don't want people grabbing the asp or the baton or the striking weapon away from the officer and using it on them. We don't do well when that happens.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Anderson.
I'm trying to understand the other part where it says, besides taking possession of a defensive device being carried by a peace officer, it also says, or from the area within the officer's immediate control. This is where we need our grammar.
Mr. Chairman.
Grammarian, Mr. Chair. Can I finish?
Senator Anderson.
To that point.
Well, can I finish my question,
yes,
please?
Senator Anderson.
I assume what this means is that if you take possession of a device being carried by a police officer from the area within the officer's immediate control, but I'm not sure if that's really clear. If I guess when I first read this, I thought it said whoever intentionally takes possession of a defensive device, which could be in the officer's immediate control. It doesn't mean it has to be the officer's device. It's
Mr.
not
Gillespie.
Necessarily
Mr.
clear.
Chairman, Senator Anderson, yes, it has to be the officer's instrumentality. And if you look back at, and in fact, looking back to your earlier question about that, for both you and Senator Fredrickson, it's the intentional taking. They have to form some intent to take that weapon. It isn't simply a matter of grab and grasp. Now, after you do that, now you've got to try to take it away from the officer. And so I think that covers that. And secondly, the immediate control was an issue that was raised in the policy committee, and so that's where that language came from. It's comfort language for some folks.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Anderson.
I guess what I was getting at is, does it have to be the officer's defensive device? That's the part that's a little ambiguous in that section. That, I assume that's the intention. It could be somebody else's gun or something else that someone else is carrying, but I assume you mean that this is only supposed to apply to an officer's defensive device.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, that's correct. It's the officer's weaponry, and I think I don't see the ambiguity, but I'll take your word for it. It'd be carried by a peace officer or from the area within the officer's immediate control, and that's was what happens when you start rolling around the ground and the gun skitters away from you or the taser skitters away from you. If it's now 30 feet down the street, did the person try to take possession of it? No, they didn't. I mean, it flew off and it's laying 30 feet away. You can't charge the person with that. You would charge them with resisting arrest or some element of assault from 2 to 4, 2 to the 4th degree, but you wouldn't charge them with this specific crime.
Okay, I don't want to get too far afield.
Mr. Chairman?
Again, the fiscal impact is, according to the notice, is non-existent. Senator Olson?
Yeah, well, Mr. Chairman, it would seem to me, I don't know if this is within that control, but if that same kind of...
This is a money control.
Mr. Gillespie, if that same kind of struggle that you described, it just came out of the person, the officer's hands, and is laying there, and somebody else grabs it intentionally. It wouldn't have been actually in his possession, but it's in within the area of his control. Is that what you're referring to? That and it if there was a struggle and you want to avoid this kind of conviction, you would let it drop and leave it there. But the taking of it intentionally would appear to bring it under this provision.
Mr.
Is that
Chairman,
correct?
Senator Olson, that you've described it perfectly.
Okay, Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, may I make an editorial change, please? On 2.8, there's a very strange phrase that says, while the officer is engaged in the performance of official duties and without the officer's consent. And I think that it's the taking it from the peace officer without the officer's consent, and so that little phrase is in the wrong spot. So I'd like to move on 2.8 after the word control, without the officer's consent, inserted there, and then deleting and without the officer's consent at the end of the sentence in the beginning, or the end of the line and beginning of 2.9. I think that makes a little more sense.
Senator Olson?
Please read it. I can't track that.
Whoever intentionally takes possession of a defensive device being carried by a peace officer or from the area within an officer's immediate control without the officer's consent while the officer is engaged in the performance of official duties is guilty of a crime, da-da-da-da-da. I think it was just stuck in a weird place that doesn't make any sense.
Okay, we have Senator Higgins' motion in front of us. Further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
Further discussion on the bill?
Chairman.
Senator Metzen moves that Senate File 2647 as amended be recommended to pass. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members.
Senator Lynch.
Yeah, but you were questioned.
When you get a chance, if you could.
That's a
nice. I know. Okay, next we have on the agenda Senate File 3385, Senator Chaudhry. This is the Omnibus Environment Bill. Totaling 101 pages. Senator Anderson moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Chaudhry, want to turn over to you, but I want, because this is a large bill and we have a fiscal note that's 25 pages long, and obviously most of this is coming from some of the dedicated funds, but I'll want Mr. Mossman within a couple minutes to speak to us relative to the general fund impact in the bill, the totality of the general fund impact in the bill. Maybe Mr. Mueller can do that as well. And make sure we understand, we get a summary of the other fund impacts. So, Senator Chaudhry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How would you like to proceed? Do you want to go over the fiscal parts of the omnibus bill, or do you want us to go through the entire bill?
Well, Senator Chaudhry, what I'd like you to do is I don't know that we need to go through the entire of the bill, but we need to know the fiscal impacts within the bill. So if there are sections that have a fiscal impact, whether general fund or otherwise, we need to know what's in there.
Parts of the bill.
Mr. Mueller is going to do that?
Oh, okay.
Or,
Mr. Chairman, did you receive a one pager in your packet that looks like
okay,
this?
I'm not. I don't think we have that.
I think they're being passed out.
Looks like they're being passed out.
They're
now,
being
Mr.
passed
Chair.
Out right now.
Let's wait a minute while we pass out the spreadsheet.
This one pager might be a little bit easier to work off of than the 25-page fiscal note, but we can refer to the fiscal note, too, if there's deeper questions on some of the issues. The one pager flows in the order of the bill also.
Yeah, we don't quite have it distributed.
Garcia.
Are we out of copies? Is that?
We just need two more. Here's yours. Unintended consequences.
All right.
Okay, Mr. Mueller.
All right, Mr. Chairman and members, I'll start on Article 1, which is the mostly provisions dealing with the PCA. A number of these provisions originally, as the bills were introduced, had fiscal implications. That's why in this top box they're all at zeros now, because in various amendments to the bill, we eliminated the costs. So basically, Article 1, there's a Senate rest bunch of provisions dealing with ballast water wrecks. Originally, that from Senate File 2517. Originally, that bill had some fiscal costs. We've since revised it a number of times to have no cost. Article 1, Section 5, dealing with ISTS licensing from a Senator Sparks bill. Originally, that bill had some costs. Revised it. There's no cost now. Article 1, Section 8, dealing with construction debris, a Senator Metzen bill. PCA said they'll absorb whatever minor cost that provision has. Article 1, Section 9, a bill from Senator Berglund dealing with permitting a site in Minneapolis, had some cost. Now there's no cost. And the last one in Article 10 that used to have costs would be a Senator Dibble provision, local notification of underground tanks. We've since revised that, and now that those costs would all fall onto the owners of the land. There is some new revenue coming in Article 1. on Section 12. This is a small revenue item that $43,000 would be going into the environmental fund, but that's just revenue going in. Nothing new is being spent. That's a toxicochemical reporting provision from Senator Chaudhry. On to Article 2, these are mostly provisions dealing with DNR. Article 1, Section 2 was an amendment put on in the budget division from Senator Bach, requiring the DNR to issue stickers for the snowmobile registration numbers.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Foley.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, and is there a way of just skipping those parts that don't have any impact that we aren't going to deal with versus where there's money involved?
Mr. Chair, Senator Foley, it's up to the committee. Whatever you'd like us to talk about, we will do that.
I think, Mr. Miller, you're going through the fiscal impact section. So,
Mr. Chairman and Senator Foley, I was just pointing out some of those previous ones that they used to have costs and now they don't, but now this snowmobile one does have $124,000 cost to it. You'll see that on the second box of my handout. Article 2, Section 2, snowmobile stickers. This was a Bach amendment. It has $124,000 cost, according to the DNR. There will be an amendment offered here that will appropriate that money from the snowmobile trails account so that they can start issuing these stickers. The next item is a DNR provision requiring that no permit is required at the Grand Portage State Park. There's just some small expenditure and revenue offsets here that will affect a couple different small non-general fund accounts over at DNR. There's a Star Lakes provision in here. There's an appropriation in the omnibus budget bill that appropriates money for the Star Lakes. There's still a section in this bill that's left over from the administrative penalty orders. There was originally four sections. We deleted most of them in the budget division. One we forgot to delete, so we'll have to delete Article 2, Section 19. So my note there says I carry no cost on there because the technical amendment will remove that section from the bill. Article 3, Section 24 and 40, and there may be other couple sections that have this change in it, is a new provision from Senator Chaudhry dealing a voluntary purchase of a walleye stamp. The expenses for that is $13,000 in 2009, and there's a little bit of ongoing expenses. That would also generate some revenue. If you see down on the revenues part of this box where I have question marks, the DNR is, they really have to put this out there and see how much revenue it would generate since it's a volunteer stamp. It would be basically anyone buying a fishing license would be asked if they wanted to buy this stamp. All the money from this stamp would go for walleye stocking. The next provision that has a cost is another amendment offered by Senator Bach in the budget division, is issuing of a conservation angling license. The cost of issuing this new license would be $8,000 out of Game and Fish Fund in 2009. But you'll see below that in the revenue section, that would have a pretty significant decrease to the Game and Fish Fund of about $2.4 million. This basically would allow people buying a fishing license to buy a conservation license at two-thirds of the cost, and they would then have a lower limit of fish to keep. Another Article 3, Section 72 is the master angler provision. This is sent from Senator Chaudhry. There is a $10,000 appropriation from the Game and Fish Fund in the bill. There's another appropriation in the bill for increased walleye stocking from Senator Mary Olson. This was a smaller version of what was originally in her bill. She had a bill that was asking for money for a specific lake, and this appropriation now is just $35,000 for increased walleye stocking. There is also appropriation from the Game and Fish Fund for fish virus surveillance. This was from the DNR's bill. Article 4, Section 4, another expense, a savings of the general fund of $66,000. There's language in this bill for the expedited land exchanges. This is also in the budget, the overall budget bill. So I'm showing the 66 here, but we're actually tracking the $66,000 savings in the overall budget bill. Now some changes in revenues. Article 2, Section 8, again, the Grand Portage, no parking permit, has a little bit of offsets in revenues between two different DNR accounts of $10,000. The aquaculture inspection on Article 3, Section 9 is a $21,000 revenue increase to the Game and Fish Fund. That was from a DNR bill. Again, the walleye stamp I mentioned before, I have question marks there because the DNR isn't really comfortable yet with specifying how much revenue they think is going to come from that. But we're not spending it in the revenue yet either. The turkey stamp, there's some changes in the bill allowing or requiring the turkey stamp to be purchased now as part of buying the turkey license. That would increase $26,000 to the turkey account. The conservation angling changes I mentioned before would be a loss of $2.4 million per year to the Game and Fish Fund. There are also a number of sections in the bill that consolidate the deer licensing system and simplifies it, but in doing so, it loses about $2.1 million per year to the Game and Fish Fund. The last part of the bill that has fiscal implications is Article 4, the land sales portions of the bill. There's a number of different land sales in the bill, and a few of them generate a little bit of revenue to the state. The $14,000 that we're tracking here for the general fund is actually being tracked in the overall budget bill, especially on the House side, but we'll track that once this passes in the overall budget bill. $1,000 generated to the permanent school fund, and $30,000 is a miscellaneous fund. So you'll see the net down at the bottom. They're all pretty small implications to non-general fund, except for the Game and Fish Fund. You'll see the net, it's a positive here. That's because it's a big loss in revenue of close to $5 million to the Game and Fish Fund as a result of this bill. And that is it for the fiscal implications.
Okay. So, Mr. Mueller, some provisions have a small general fund impact, is that correct? But the net is zero?
Mr. Chairman, right now the impact on the general fund is zero on this bill. Like I said, the $66,000 savings, that's the same language as in the overall budget bill. We have the same language in here. That's why I'm showing that 66 in brackets, because we're tracking it in the other bill. And the other general fund implication is on the land sales, and that's actually an increase in revenue. But that's it for the general fund.
And are any of the other provisions tracking in the supplemental finance bill?
Mr. Chairman, on the Senate side, no.
Okay.
On the House side, some of these items are being tracked in the overall budget bill.
All right. So other than the general fund appropriations, nothing is tracking in other bills in the Senate.
Correct.
Correct?
Right.
Okay, thank you. Questions for Mr. Mueller on, if we go to the fiscal note, obviously you've done the spreadsheet from the fiscal note.
Right.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Mueller on the fiscal, either the fiscal note or Mr. Mueller's one-page spreadsheet. Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mueller, if we are spending about $5 million out of the Game and Fish Fund, and I don't think we have that much in new revenues, right? What does that fund look like?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, it's actually just a loss in revenue. It's not new expenditures out of the Game and Fish Fund. And right now there is about a $12 to $15 million balance in the Game and Fish Fund. But that's sort of a comfortable balance that the DNR likes keeping in the Game and Fish Fund. these changes would slowly eat away within a couple of years at that fund balance.
Mr. Chair. And the only way to restore those funds is typically to raise license fees, correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, there's a number of different revenues that go into the Game and Fish Fund, but the major one is license fees.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
How do they account for a decline in hunting and fishing? I know that there's been concerns expressed about fewer people buying hunting licenses and fishing licenses. How do they project that into their budget for the Game and Fish Fund?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, I think the DNR has testified that they have that fear looking off in the future. Right now, I think the license sales are kind of flat, maybe slowly going down. Like I said, they have a fund balance in the account right now that they're able to maybe absorb some of those decreases. Some of these changes they're hoping actually will increase some sales. Doing this conservation fish license, they may be hoping that by offering a lower-priced fishing license for those who maybe do not plan on want to catch their limit all the time, will actually increase some sales. And also the changes to the deer license simplification, that maybe more people will buy deer hunting license. So the loss in revenue here is projected. They haven't really tried projecting any new sales in these numbers. I know some people in the committee have argued that these are maybe over high estimates of lost revenue because they don't account for maybe increased sales as a result of these changes. But yes, the DNR has testified that they maybe have are worried about some decreased participation in hunting and fishing in the future. But
Mr. Chair.
And over in the long run, yes, it could have a negative effect on the Game and Fish Fund.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Roebling. I think on the issue of the conservation angler license, you know, I personally have really mixed feelings about it because it is a big cost, and it will decrease revenues likely. But part of the argument in favor of it is that it will help because it's a lower price license. It might get more people into fishing that might not otherwise buy a license. And it's sort of an entry-level permit in a way because you don't have to, you go in, you buy this lower-cost license with the understanding, with the requirement that you don't catch the limit. And so it's good for sort of new anglers who want to try out the sport. And so on the one hand, I think it might bring new people in. On the other hand, it might cost the fund. So it's sort of a gamble for us. And I am concerned about the future of this fund.
Yeah. Senator Chaudhry?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, just a footnote. The House has not proposed, I don't believe it's proposed either of yes, it has. The House has done that, but they don't have the.
Yeah, I'm not sure what's going on with our sound system, but other questions? Okay, Mr. Mueller has gone through the provisions of the bill. Senator Chaudhry, is there anything? Senator Tomasoni?
Mr. Chairman, do they work now? Well, there we go.
Senator Tomasoni?
I have an 825 amendment.
Okay, if we could have that distributed.
Thank you.
Okay, we have the amendment distributed. Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, what this amendment does is it allows for, or it requires fish stocking in Leech Lake, and probably the best way for me to do this would to have Senator Mary Olson explain why it's needed.
Okay, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Senator, and members, this amendment, if you were to adopt this amendment, it would reflect what the policy committee passed. In the Environment Finance Committee, there was a lot of discussion and a good deal of testimony on this. The Finance Committee then voted in a divided vote, voted to take this language out. Since then, there have been discussions with between Senator Olson, who is the author of the bill, and various senators, and that has resulted in this amendment being reintroduced on behalf of Senator Olson. I think it's accurate to say that the city of city of Walker really wants this amendment. The DNR really does not want this amendment. But the policy committee did have a lot of testimony on this. So did the Environment Finance Committee. I should also note that this committee passed the standalone bill as well. And so that's why this has been was originally included in my omnibus bill. Pursuant to further discussions that have been had between the Senator Anderson's committee and this committee, Senator Tomasoni has offered to reinsert this language in the bill, and I would support it.
Okay. Senator Olson, did you wish to speak to the amendment?
Mr. Chair, to the extent that, you know, you want to take testimony regarding the background of this, I have the mayor from Walker and a biologist and a couple of other witnesses, but very briefly, there's been a long-standing debate between the DNR and the city of Walker regarding the walleye fishery in Leech Lake. And over a period of time, because the lake was not stocked at a point where it should have been, the walleye population really diminished to the point that over 30 businesses in a very small community of Walker were lost. There's kind of a mystery regarding why the natural fishery is not reproducing the way it once was. But there are a couple of suspects. One is the rusty crayfish that is an invasive species there, and there are some studies ongoing to determine if that's what's causing the problem. In the meantime, the community finally did convince the DNR to stock, and unlike what the DNR had thought, the stocking actually was very successful. And has done a lot to begin to restore the walleye population in Leech Lake. This bill simply asks for 2 more years of stocking while these studies are ongoing to try to discover why the natural reproduction is not occurring, because the community really can't sustain any further economic losses.
Okay. Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's a good idea to stock Leech Lake, and I'll tell you, I fish on Leech Lake every year, but I think it's a bad idea to start naming lakes in our state statutes, because if we do this, if we name Leech Lake, Senator Vickerman's going to have a bill next year to stock Lake Chautauqua. Senator Messick's going to have a bill next year to stock Big Sandy. Senator Roebling will have a bill next year to stock Fish Lake. Every one of us is going to have a bill here naming a specific lake.
I won't.
So I think we should work with the Department of Natural Resource, get some assurance from them that they'll use this money to for the purposes that we intend without putting it into the state law.
Senator Chaudhry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate Senator Fredrickson's comments. I just want to note that this is not an arbitrary situation. This is a result of a long history of discussions about stocking in Leech Lake. The testimony in favor of this bill on the part of not only the community but walleye biologists have testified in favor of this. So this is a very unique situation. It comes from a long history of stocking discussion and policy with regard to Leech Lake in particular. So this is not something that the community rose up and said, gee, we'd like to do some additional stocking. We think it's important. We disagree with the DNR, and so let's go to our legislators. This is really a result of a long history of discussions within the community, studies, advisory committees, reports, and so this is where we're at with that. So I really don't think this is going to lead to other pieces of legislation coming forward to stock various pieces of various lakes. I live on a lake too in northern Minnesota in my free time, and I would like that lake to be stocked as well, but I'm not going to have a piece of legislation to have that done. So the policy committee really talked about this for a long time. In fact, so did Senator Anderson's committee, and so I think it's okay to do this. I think it's a good idea. It's got biological backing. There is biological disagreement, but there's certainly biological backing behind doing this amendment.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Fredrickson.
Chairman, could we briefly hear from the Department of Natural Resources and what they plan to do with Leech Lake?
Certainly. Commissioner Myers.
Mr. Chair, members, good morning and thank you. For the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. We are committed to the health of Leech Lake. Over the past 4 years, we've stocked approximately 70 million fry into the lake. We're going to put another 21 million fry approximately in there this spring. The situation at hand is we need to assess the biological population, the biological health of that lake. So we want to have a blank year to complete our lake assessment, comprehensive lake management plan next year. So we can determine the stocking benefits, how the natural reproduction has been occurring, and then with the community, develop a long-range stocking plan. We are not walking away from this community any way, shape, or form. We are very concerned and committed about the fishery at hand. Senator Fredrickson is absolutely right. Putting this language into statute will bring in the next lakes. It puts in, and if it's your desire, to bring the legislature into the biological management and stocking of the fisheries in the state of Minnesota. As I said, we are committed to working with the lake associations and the resources up there, but we do have concerns about putting this language into statute.
Okay, thank you. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have had numerous meetings, as has the Walker community, with the DNR, and even proposed some compromise language to the DNR with respect to this community task force he's talking about that would have given them some assurance that there would be adequate stocking, and that plan was rejected by the DNR because they, again, this is a very unique situation where there's been a debate between the community and their own biologists. They formed a task force, and in terms of what's causing the lack of natural reproduction. And during the policy committee, the DNR biologist who testified there must have said at least 10 times that there is a mystery and there is uncertainty with regard to this natural reproduction. They have studies underway to try to determine that, and the community is simply asking that their community have a chance to rebuild itself. They have. There's been an economic study done in the area of Walker that shows that over $50 million has been lost in that very small economy because of the lack of walleye to draw people to what's traditionally been a resort community. And the DNR resisted doing any stocking at all through over 10 years of debate with the community until finally so much pressure was brought to bear that there was some limited stocking. And while that may sound like a lot of stocking in comparison for the size of the lake, it's a much smaller percentage of stocking than it is done on most of the other lakes around. And yet it has been very successful. At the same time, there has been no indication that natural reproduction has picked up. And as the DNR biologist has said, they don't know why that isn't happening, but they're having continuing studies. The DNR has stated many times to the Walker community that they don't feel, once again, they don't feel the lake continues to be stocked, and they have resisted anything that would give the community some control over assuring their the economy in the area. So, again, I just like to emphasize, I certainly won't be back here again on behalf of any other lake in my district, and I have many of them. This is a very unique situation with a very long history, and as Senator Chaudhry has said, some disagreement about the biology involved, but some very in-depth studies. So again, I would really appreciate your support on behalf of this community. They lost their largest employer, the Agua Ching Regional Center there, and this is really their second largest area of employment is in the resort business, and they're really desperate.
All right. We've had discussion on the amendment. Are there further questions, comments, Senator Vickerman?
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to remember what the testimony was in that in the committee. I guess my concern is if we take all the fry and put them in one lake, how many do we have left to 10,000 lakes? I can't remember what was said.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Chaudhry.
Senator Vickerman, the testimony from the DNR was that they do have the capacity to do this should we pass it. They don't desire that we pass it, but if we were to, they do have the physical numbers to be able to do this. So this would not take away from any other lake.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, that's exactly correct, and that's why we made in the division, we added the word additional, so we would be clear that this would be $25 million in addition to what the DNR was intending to stock otherwise. So this would be above and beyond.
Okay. Further questions? Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many fish were going to be stocked already? What is the annual stock for Leech Lake without this additional stock?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, this year we're anticipating approximately 21 million fry. That's based upon availability. The committee in Finance Committee, we did discuss, it's all based upon our ability to access those fry. Any stocking year right now, it's going to be a little bit kind of iffy with the weather, but we'll do our best to get what fry we can get out and get it stocked into lakes. As I mentioned, next year we wanted to cut back on our stocking to assess the actual health and the natural reproduction of the lake, and then with the scientific plan at hand, the comprehensive lake management plan, work with the community to develop a long-range stocking program.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, and to be more specific in answer to Senator Roebling's question, the DNR has indicated that their plan is to stock no fish after this year, and that's what brought this bill forward in the next 2 years, and that's why the request, and also it says up to 35,000 fish, so that if these fish are not available, there's not an absolute number in terms of how many would have to be stocked.
Okay, further questions on the A25 amendment? Further discussion? If not, Senator Tomasoni, Senator Betzel, Senator Tomasoni moves the A25 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Division.
Division. Okay, all those in favor signify by raising your hand. Opposed?
Two of them that told me they'd vote with me changed their mind. She had biologists and
contested. Okay, motion fails on a vote of 8-9. Further discussion on the bill. Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I have the A26 amendment.
Why are we doing policy? Why are we doing policy amendments in the Finance Committee? I thought that was a rule against doing that. That was a reason.
That was money.
That was
money.
We have it all. How many times do we change that stuff in the Committee?
themselves. Thank you.
Because we get reached to each other.
But you're right. You're sick. You pointed out a lake.
How do you spend the money?
So she didn't have her money.
Right.
Again, so that's too bad. That's what happened. Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
This is the technical amendment that Mr. Mueller referenced that just makes a couple of corrections that we need to do to comply with what's in the fiscal note. First of all, it deletes a section on APOs. Let's see, I'm trying to find that. Page 24. That shouldn't have been in there. The administrative penalty orders that was not intended to be in the bill. And then it includes the appropriation for the snowmobile number strips and conforms that with what we've been told the cost will be to have those numbers available when people buy their snowmobile license.
Okay. Senator Chaudhry?
Support the amendment.
Okay, we have the A26 amendment in front of us, moved by Senator Anderson. Is there further discussion on the amendment? If not, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Further discussion on the bill?
Oh.
Senator Stumpf.
This is just a question more than anything, and it has to relate to the section relating to the ballast discharge. And I believe in there, the commissioner of MPCA is the one that is given the responsibility. But it seems to me that, and I know on your fiscal note you had no cost or the agency was going to absorb the cost. There must be a cost associated with that because it's a new program and one. And I have no clue as to how many ships go in and out of Duluth or how many vessels that would be deemed to fall under this legislation. But it seems like the responsibilities would be such that it would take time and personnel to follow up with this ballast discharge. And I never really agreed with that program because it's not international waters, but it's multinational or it's multinational, multi-state waters, depending on where you are. And so I'm just curious as to how the fiscal note was developed and how MPCA might end up carrying this out.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stump, the fiscal, it's on page 16 of the fiscal note. You'll see at the top of it, it's Article 1, Sections 2, 3, and 4, where this is what came from PCA, and I don't know if there's anyone from PCA here right now to testify on what they put into the fiscal note, but basically says these sections would not have a fiscal impact on the MPCA beyond the current resources devoted to developing the permits right now. So that's what PCA put into the bill, and I don't know if they're here at all to testify.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Mueller.
Senator Stumpf.
It's my understanding when you read the legislation, a management plan has to be, a record book has to be kept on each ship or each boat that's going to have ballast discharge. And then a management plan has to be set up. And that management plan, I mean, who's going to monitor it and who's going to read the books and who's going to be sure that that's enforced? Or is this just, I mean, that's to me, that's a cost.
Senator Rest, is it?
Morning, Mr. Chairman and members, Senator Stump. The language within the bill actually is mirroring what the PCA is doing currently in developing a framework for permitting those ships that enter into Minnesota waters, and there is a definition for that. The ships have these record books on board they would be on terms of the ballast water management plans. There's a lot of flexibility in the language for the PCA to approve those. Some ships only release ballast water are only common to Minnesota waters maybe once every 3 or 4 years. They don't carry their record books in English. There is flexibility in one section of the amendment that was added that allows the PCA to not require that they have those ballast water record books in English. In addition, the right now, the PCA is, again, developing. They've had 2 or 3 meetings. They plan to have their permitting process done by October 1st for both ocean-going vessels and Lakers. And the authority under which they are developing the permitting process is their administrative authority, as well as their general rulemaking authority, and they are not they are already undertaking this, and so there is no additional cost of this legislation or of this part of this amendment.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, it sounds like they may need an interpreter too.
Well, for once every Mr. Chairman, Senator Stump, for once, you know, for those ships that would enter Minnesota waters, the international ships very rarely, you know, taking the time to get an interpreter of whatever language the record is kept in did not seem to be an overdue burden.
Okay. Would you like to offer some testimony?
Mr. Chair, committees, I'm Myrna Hallback with the Pollution Control Agency. I'm the Chief Financial Officer. Senator Rest did a great job of explaining it. This is essentially what we're doing under the development of our permit and working with it. Doesn't add extra work to us that we envision through the permit process to do. Additionally, relative to the language barrier, we have a standard contract that we can fulfill, because even when we're working in some of the communities around Minnesota, we sometimes need a translator with the new immigrants and that. And so we actually do have a standing contract. If we needed it in this case, we would use that as well.
Mr. Chairman, just one final question. Do you do any enforcement?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, we do enforcement in this case. That we would coordinate with the Coast Guard, as they have the authority actually to enter onto the ships in bulk. So they would get our permit, and we would coordinate with the Coast Guard and others to enforce it.
Thank you. Further discussion on the bill, further amendments. Senator Roblin.
Mr. Chair, I'd like some clarification on Section 25. I realize it's not a money issue for the state, or it might be in some ways. It has to do with the purchasing of some land by Carlos Avery, Avery and Lamprey Pass Wildlife Management Areas. And did Senator Rest just leave? Because I'm on the State and Local Government Committee, and I don't remember that this – did this come through state and local government policy?
Senator Chaudhry.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, I know that Senator Rest did not request to hear it. In fact, I asked Senator Rest if she needed to hear it, and she said no. But I'm trying to recall if this provision went through the committee and as a part of any other omnibus bill. And
Mr. Chair.
I don't think so.
And Senator Roblin?
I don't recall it, and I think it's a really an unusual precedent. I just was reading it for the first time. I had not seen it before. And did this request for purchasing of this land go all the way through the Land Exchange Board already? Has that process played itself out?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, no, because it, in order to go through the Land Exchange Board, it has to either a period of 90 days of no action on the part of a county has to expire, or there has to be a court action. So neither of those occurred. And this was one of the concerns last year with this proposal, was that there was court action going on, and the legislature, certain members of the legislature, didn't want to interfere with that. And that is not the case here. There's no court action going on.
But, Mr. Chair,
Roebling.
But we have not followed, we have a whole process set out in law, apparently, on how we permit the acquisition of public lands. And in this particular case, are we not going to follow that? The legislature's kind of preempting that with this provision on page 43 that says it doesn't apply in this case, this procedure that we have laid out for everyone else to follow.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, I characterize it in a different way. We're not, this is a state law, so we're not preempting anything. We are preventing someone from, the current law prevents or preempts someone from selling their land voluntarily. And so this would allow this to occur because this is a unique situation, as you said. This does not apply to rural areas or really any other area in the metropolitan area, because this is a unique wildlife management area. It's the largest wildlife management area in the metro.
Mr. Chair,
generally,
obviously it wouldn't preempt them from selling to anyone, but in this case it would be for this purpose, because the landowner has the right to sell his land to a private party, but it needs the county board approval or to have gone through the process with the Land Exchange Board, correct, in order to be accepted as a public purchase. Is that that's the normal process, correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, partially. They can only go through the Land Exchange Board if the county does not act or there was court action as a result of the county's action. So it's more accurate to say that a landowner has only to the only option is for a landowner is to get approval by the county, unless the county does not act.
Mr.
So there is no option on the part of the landowner, or there is no choice to go through the Land Exchange Board, solely on the part of the landowner.
Mr. Chair, you indicated that the 90 days has not expired for the county board to act. They have not taken action one way or the other, and they're still in their 90 days?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, no. The county board has acted and denied the landowners their ability to sell this land.
Mr. Chair, Senator Shadrick, then why wouldn't it go to the Land Exchange Board? Why wouldn't that be the next natural step?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, because the law requires that the landowner take the county to court first. They cannot just go to the Land Exchange Board if that's a denial, if they have been denied.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm going to have to find out more about this, and maybe we can talk about it on the floor. It seems to me that if the county gave good reasons for not wanting the land in public ownership, that it would not necessarily go to the Land Exchange Board. But if they didn't spell out good reasons that the request could be denied, I don't know what those reasons, what kind of reasons they gave. Did they gave reasons why they didn't want it taken into public ownership?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, they cited reasons. Whether they're good reasons is ambiguous at best.
Well, Mr. Chair, I probably will talk further to find out what reasons they cited and whether I think, everybody has different opinions on it, but I'd like to find out what the county's saying about it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling and members, we've discussed this provision in our bill at length in the Policy Committee and in the Finance Committee.
Senator Betzel.
Well, and Mr. Chair, it was taken out of the bill and added back in when there was only three members there, is my understanding. Now, Senator Chaudhry, now, what is the reason why we are doing this? Because you disagree with the county, what's the reason?
Chair, Senator Betzel, many reasons. First of all, I'm concerned about development on undevelopable property along state wildlife management area, and that there's a state law that allows this to occur. I'm concerned about individual property owners' ability to voluntarily sell their property to whom they choose. Area we're talking about here is a very unique area in the entire state of Minnesota because it's the largest wildlife management area in the metro in the Twin Cities, and that I've narrowly crafted this to apply only to this particular area. I'm concerned that we in a county that has been deemed one of the fastest growing counties in the entire country, that we make sure that we take a step back and protect our open spaces, and that we protect voluntary activity for a person's own property. There is no harm to the locality by this bill. If there is truly a desire on the part of the municipality to develop this land or these lands, these parcels, they can buy the property at any time. This bill does not prevent that. And if they don't want to buy it or can't afford to buy it, they could buy an option to buy it too, to reserve this property for development. The city has not done any of that and has just simply arbitrarily blocked these people from selling their property. I have a letter from one of the property owners' realtors that indicates that private buyers have not wished to purchase this property because it's not developable. And I'm happy to distribute that. And why don't we go ahead and distribute the information while we're at it? We've got a number of pieces of information. We'll just distribute right now. So there are a lot of reasons why we need to protect this because Carlos Avery is a very unique piece of property. We have a different situation in the metro area than in rural areas. We have this law, and I think it applies better in greater Minnesota because there are large tracts of public lands in rural areas, and there is concern about having development in those areas, and so the county would like to review that. We have the opposite situation in the metropolitan area where we have a lot of development and very little public land. And as a result, we end up not preserving critical open spaces in the face of a lot of growth. So in this situation where we have a unique piece of public property, the largest wildlife management area in the metropolitan area, we have parcels that are more suited for protection than they are development. And these, by the way, these are only parcels along the only parcels that are contiguous along the current wildlife management area, that we're not trying to create a checkerboard effect of public land, that this area needs protection, and the private property rights need protection as well. So those are the reasons why we need this provision. Similar. Well, Mr. Chair, that's
you know, and again, this is a policy issue. Last year, I made the motion to take it out of this particular committee. Senator Chaudhry used that as a big argument all the way forward, saying nobody supported my motion to take it out on the floor. It actually did take it out. So this is probably not the appropriate time, you know, to remove it, to fuel that argument again. But it just sort of seems to me that if what he's saying is true, then maybe these principles ought to be applied, if not statewide, at least metro-wide, and not to one individual piece of property that, for whatever reason, he is seeking to protect.
Mr. Chair and Senator Betzold, I appreciate the comment. What I would respond to is that there hasn't been a problem in the rest of the metro area or the rest of the state, and that's why this bill is narrowly crafted to address a problem. Senator Roebling brought up the idea of proper reasoning for denying a person's ability to sell their own property. And I think there is a lot of discretion on the part of a municipality that goes along with applying the state law. It's my feeling that that discretion has been abused. Last year we were arguing over a problem over one landowner. This year, at least three or four other landowners have come forward with the same problem in the same municipality. So that exacerbates the problem that people are having. There has been no reason given that we would like to – if the municipality had come forward and said, we've tried to purchase this property and we're trying to develop it, we've zoned it for development, we have a plan for what we'd like to put there, and therefore we would like the county to deny this sale to the DNR because we have alternative plans and here they are, that would be one thing. I would still be against it. I err on the side of preservation, but at least there would be an argument. But the city has not zoned this area, these properties, for development. There has been no offer on the part of the city to purchase these properties. There has been no indication that this to the landowners in specific that we would like to purchase your property for development. In addition to that, the Stankey property, and the Stankeys are here. They're here to testify in support. That property is in a shoreland protection zone. It's in a wetland. And it's in a floodplain. And the letters from the realtors have reinforced the fact that people have not wanted to buy this property, even for a horse barn, because there are too many wetlands on this area and it can't be developed. So there's really no reason has been given that they even want to develop this property. So really, you know, I think when you have a situation where you have a person who wants to sell their property, they're interested in retiring, moving on with their lives. They have a willing buyer for their property. They are willing sellers, and they've been nonetheless stymied. And you've got a piece of property that is more fit for protection than development. You know, I think the law in this particular area has been abused. And so where there is abuse of the law should be changed. Where there has not been abuse of the law should not be changed. And so that's why I've narrowly crafted this bill just to this particular situation.
Okay, do we have a motion in front of us?
Chairman, do we have any amendments pending?
That's what I just asked. Senator
then
Anderson.
I would move the bill as amended be recommended to pass.
Okay, Senator Anderson.
Chair, I have two amendments. Haven't had a chance to offer them yet. I did raise my hand, so I know we've been busy discussing things.
Okay.
I have the A28 amendment.
Discussion if they don't have a motion to take it out.
Hold the
this is going to pay for
Mr. that. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Senator Chaudhry, I apologize if I didn't show this to Senator Chaudhry. I can't remember if I had a chance to show this to him or not. But, Mr. Chair, this is what I had discussed when we did Senator Michelle's bill on safety standards for swimming pools. And I had talked about this in the Finance Committee and as well as on the floor, that I was extremely concerned about the prospect of pools opening this summer without safety standards fully implemented. And after the Senate floor debate, we amended the bill with Senator Lynch's amendment so that the safety standards all have to occur this year. And so I had talked with my working group as part of the Finance Conference Committee about the idea of setting aside a very small amount of money from the from existing funding, the Natural Resource Fund, to provide some small grants for those local governments that needed help in upgrading their wading pools, their free public wading pools this summer. And so that's what this amendment represents, is a total of $50,000 that we are proposing, $25,000 from the Metro Parks Natural Resources Fund and $25,000 from the State Trail Program. So I should be really clear, this is not cutting or taking money away from any existing appropriations. This is a fund that exists that is used to fund those parks and trails programs, but it's not currently appropriated. So it does not represent any kind of a cut. And so we incorporated half of the money from the Metro Parks and half from a state program so that it would be a truly statewide pot of money that would be available. Why is everyone giving me these looks? And the grants would be up to $10,000 per pool. And I thought it was important to put this in Senator Chaudhry's bill so that we could have a Senate position on this and that we could vote on this in the full Senate. So I would move the 828 amendment.
Senator Anderson, we have a couple questions about the drafting, but Mr. Mossman?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, members, pardon any looks. The language I was reading, and I'm not familiar, and maybe either yourself or Mr. Mueller, I assume, it could answer the questions also. I was just looking at the revenues, and I see the later sentences starting on 1.12 are tied to revenues coming in, and revenues at least have the potential of not materializing, but yet the appropriation is fixed at $50,000, and so the question is there a need to tie it to the revenue stream since revenues can potentially not materialize?
Well, I my understanding is this money is in the accounts already, so I'm not quite sure. Maybe that's just a drafting.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson and Mr. Mossman, yes, there is an available fund balance in this account, in these two accounts within the Natural Resources Fund. One is the Metro Parks account. This money all comes from the lottery in lieu revenues, and there is available fund balance in both those accounts. This is just one-time money coming out of those accounts. So,
Mr. Chairman.
So, Mr. Mueller, has the amendment been drafted correctly to reflect the money's there now, but if the money were not to be there, should it be redrafted to reflect revenues coming in?
Mr. Chairman, everything spent out of these accounts are directly appropriated. They're not open and standing appropriations. So there is available revenue has exceeded the expenditures for the time being in this account. So there is an available fund balance in this account, both accounts.
Mr. Mossman.
Mr. Chair, members, the question I think would be if it's coming from the available fund balance of the account, if on line 1.12, starting with the sentence that says of this amount, if those two sentences that tied to the revenues were not there, it would still come from the fund balance the way the amendment is drafted, I believe.
Mr. Chairman, the drafting of this is just is the standard way we do this from the lottery in lieu account. In fact, in your bill and in conference right now, in House File 1812, this is how and how we've done previous appropriation bills. Since the accounts aren't necessarily set up in statute, we always include this language for all the lottery and lieu money at the end, basically stating what, because 297A.94 just shows where the revenue goes into these various purposes. And so this is just standard boilerplate language that we've done in every other appropriation bill for money from the lottery and lieu accounts.
Mr. Chair.
Chairman Faraso.
Mr. Chair, I understood that part of this was coming out of Metro Parks. You had the divided between two different funds, but one of them is Metro Parks. And I believe they have a big list of stuff going on already that could be used for any money they were already appropriated. And so if it's there, I'm concerned that this might be just taking it away from some other projects that could be designated or might already be designated.
Mr. Chair.
Anderson.
Senator Faraso, this is not taking it away from anything that we have appropriated. This is money that's in the fund to be available for next year's future appropriations, and it's also funded by lottery and lieu payments every year. So it's sort of it's a fund balance, and it's not, you know, we fully funded in our bill the Metro Parks operating dollars and request this session. So this does not take away from any appropriations that the legislature has considered doing.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just thinking that they have priority lists that are already there, and we all know that some things rise and some things fall because of funding or non-funding, and so I'm concerned that that could happen.
Senator Paraso,
I don't run the parks. I'm sorry, but I know that the people who do have definite priority lists.
If the Metro Parks had proposed any priorities to me that were not being funded, I would certainly consider that those would take priority. But we've funded what they requested in our bills. And we did not accept any governor's cuts to the parks or trails in our bills. And so I don't think this would cause any harm to those budgets. And I also think it's a matter of safety and of children being able to swim in pools safely this summer. So it's a critical issue, and I think it's a small thing that we could do, a small amount of money out of the big scheme of our budget that could potentially save people's lives, save children's lives this summer. So I think it's critically important.
Sarah Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to thank you, Senator Anderson, for working on this. I really appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Chaudhry.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just one quick question, Senator Anderson. Do you know if this would violate any of the conditions of the Natural Resource Fund's expenditures?
Mr. Chair, I certainly don't believe it would, and we've talked this over with staff, and I'm not aware of any problems.
This is notwithstanding.
Mr. Watson, did you?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson.
There is a technical.
Yeah.
Thank you. I think we just have to change on line 15, change C, where it says paragraph C. And on line 16, where it says paragraph C, those should both say paragraph E.
Right.
Is that that's the technical change?
Mr. Watson,
to be incorporated.
Mr. Chairman,
Watson,
yes.
Says, okay. Senator Anderson, technical amendment. We'll incorporate that into the amendment, Senator Frederick.
Chair, I just briefly wanted to speak in support of this amendment also, and this is going through an existing Department of Natural Resource program that has an excellent reputation and is very well run. Local units of government, metro and rural, program. I think this is a very good amendment.
And Mr. Chair, I guess the only other thing I didn't say, appreciate that, is that we're requiring. This would be up to a 75% grant of the total cost, so the local government would have to do some cost share.
Okay, we have Senator Anderson's 828 amendment. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Further discussion on the bill. Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I have one other amendment, the 827 amendment. And this, Senator Dibble can speak to this if there's any questions, if you'd like him. I'll wait till it's passed out.
Okay. happy to take the amendment. You know, I heard a question on the table relative to Senator Tomasoni's earlier amendment, which was borderline in terms of policy or finance because it involves stocking a fish and the possible cost of doing so was certainly on the side of finance. Is this a finance amendment?
Well, Mr. Chair, why is it that you always think to ask that question when I offer my amendments? I've noticed a number of amendments this week in committee that are, Mr. Chair, let me just explain why I think it would be helpful for us to do this amendment now. It doesn't strictly relate to finance, no. However, it's the kind of the third iteration of a bill that originally had a fiscal impact, and it's some agreed upon language that cleans up a provision in the bill, and so it really would just be, I think, efficient for us to adopt it now and get the bill in the correct shape.
Right,
I don't think it's controversial. It's agreed upon language that really clarifies what's in the bill, and so Senator Dibble had asked me to.
Right, there are no rules in the committee, relative to germaneness as we have on the floor of the Senate, but I do make that point, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Anderson is correct when she says that the original version of the bill that was incorporated into the omnibus bill had an $800,000 fiscal note provided by the PCA. So this makes double, triple sure that there is no fiscal impact to the state budget. What this seeks to do is to make sure that those who had received notice of a fuel tank leak investigation through this mechanism called a receptor survey have the benefit of a little bit of additional follow-up after they receive that initial notice, that request for information about impacts on their property, so they're not left to wonder whatever came of the investigation of the fuel leak in the vicinity of where they reside.
Well, okay.
Mr. Chair, it just...
Senator Anderson.
It just basically cleans up the language that's in there and eliminates opposition to this provision, and so I just think it would be helpful if the committee would adopt it at this time.
Senator Chaudhry.
Mr. Chair, this is one of those peace in the valley amendments, and might as well take care of it now.
Okay. A little bit borderline. Further discussion on the H-27 amendment? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Further discussion on the bill?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, I have the A-32 amendment.
Okay, well, that's being distributed. Senator Fredrickson, can you chair for a second? Senator Fischbach, on your A-32 amendment.
Well, Mr. Chair, as it's being passed out, I apologize to Senator Chaudhry for not bouncing this off of you earlier, but we did talk about it earlier in the session regarding a sportsman's club that's now being charged a fee for a fishing tournament, and we kind of scaled it back. What had happened is one of the sportsman's clubs went to apply for their fishing tournament permit this year, they found out that they were now being charged for it. And this happens to be, unless they registered as a nonprofit corporation, and that is rather extensive. They were told by the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources they had to be a 501c3, which is a register with the federal government and all kinds of things. And they are registered as a nonprofit corporation with the Secretary of State. And the tournament that they run is catch and release. It's only for members. They don't make any profit on it. Everything's either used for prizes or food. So this isn't like they're a big money maker for them. It's simply a fishing tournament. And so we tried to narrow the language so that it would only apply to a very small number of organizations.
Senator Chaudhry, did you want to comment on the amendment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fischbach, what would be the fiscal note on this bill, on this provision?
Senator Fischbach?
How much of license fees would we lose?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we don't have a fiscal note, but... Or do you have, I'm sorry.
No.
Maybe staff could help us out because I just got the amendment myself.
Somebody from the Department of Natural
Resources. Mr. Chair, I believe it would be very small because I think it's very narrowly drawn. Also, the
commissioner may wait. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the tape.
Mr. Chair and members, Ed Bogus, Deputy Director of Fish and Wildlife for the Department of Natural Resources, and we don't know for sure what the impact of this would be, but the whole fishing contest fee is a new program, and we're just in our first year of administering it. So the charitable exemption that's in there right now, we don't know for sure what the total impact of that would be. If we add the not-for-profit to the charitable, we think that that's going to encompass a significant number of the sponsors of these tournaments because a lot of them are clubs and conservation clubs. So the original intent of this provision was to recover the cost of administering these tournaments. If we go this road, we're probably not going to come close to recovering the cost of administering the tournaments. We may in the future look at participant fees rather than contest fees. Our Game and Fish Fund Oversight Committee would like to see us recover the costs of administering tournaments rather than having the general angler do that. So we don't know for sure what the fiscal impact would be.
Senator Murphy.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to ask Senator Tomasoni if he got a bill together on, is this your amendment? Oh, it's Senator Fishbach. Okay.
Fishbach, yeah.
Right. Mr. Chair, Senator Murphy, do we sound that much alike?
Well, no, it was the tactic, Senator.
Oh.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bogus, can you tell us about how much the fee is for a tournament?
Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Senator, the fees right now are capped by, you can actually see the language at the bottom of the amendment. For an open water contest not exceeding 100 participants, $120, more than 100 participants, $400, and so forth. And so roughly, the maximum is roughly $4 per participant.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, in the tournaments as they have been run, how would you break out that current participation in terms of the ones that are charitable organizations, not-for-profits, versus what else is there? Are there groups that organize just for a profit-making purpose for running a fishing contest?
Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, there are some large tournaments that are televised and have large prize purses that are run as a business rather than as a not-for-profit. But we do think most of them are probably in the latter category of not-for-profit organizations that just put these tournaments on not to make a profit but to have an event for their club or whatever.
Well, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bogus, is your plan to have any kind of differential for those kinds of participants, or is it all based on just the size and number of participants?
Mr. Bogus?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry I didn't quite catch Senator Olson's question.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Olson. I hadn't studied the whole current law here in terms of how that breaks out. If the ones that would be affected by this were small organizations, as Senator Fishbach indicated, how that fee might, under current law, might stack up in comparison with some of the biggies that you're talking about.
Mr. Bogus?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I think that the not-for-profits would be more in the categories of one and two there, the $120 or the $400. There are only a couple of the ones that are in item four there that's $1,000, and those tend to be the for-profit types.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fishbach, my concern is that we're trying to figure out across the agency and the DNR in particular, but other agencies in our division as well, how to make sure that the programs do cover the costs to the agencies and that the permit fees and license fees, et cetera, cover the cost to the agency. because we just can't afford to subsidize all these programs anymore as with taxpayer dollars. And that's really what the alternative would be, that we're subsidizing it with general fund taxpayer dollars. And so I have some concern about this. I guess this is the – I'd like to have more information. I wonder, is this something – I'm sorry I missed your introductory statement about who you were trying to help here. But have you this? You know, have you introduced a bill on this?
Yes.
I think
Senator Fishbach.
Mr. Chair, yes, and I requested hearings and was not granted a hearing on it, and would have been happy to have a conversation at great length at that point. And I think that we have certainly narrowed it, and this is permissive language. It says the commissioner may waive the fee. This doesn't say shall. So, this and it is for. All of the contest participants are members of the club, so we're not talking about a huge number of folks. And, the Sportsman's Club came to me and just really felt that, the requirement of a 501c3 to become a nonprofit organization, that's not what they're about. Paperwork is not what they're about, and applying for that is expensive, and there's yearly reporting, and they have been around since, I think they said, 1956 or something as a sportsman's club.
Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Fishbach, now I'm kind of confused because I thought you said it's too complicated to register as a not-for-profit corporation, but that's what this refers to. They have to be one to be eligible.
Senator Fishbach.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, there's several different kinds. They are registered. They are a not-for-profit corporation registered with the Office of the Secretary of State. What they were told by DNR is that they have to register as a 501c3.
And so, Mr. Chair, can you, and I apologize if you already said this, but why, how big is this group? And you're talking, could we narrow it a lot more so that the circumstances that you're talking about, I mean, this is sort of a wide open exception that would kind of swallow the whole rule, it seems to me, for just about any sporting organization that was nonprofit. And, the cost of the bait is going to be more than it would cost to pay for this permit for each individual person. If it's, a couple bucks per person, $5 per person, that would cover the cost of this fee. So
it's reasonable.
Senator Fishbach.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm willing to withdraw the amendment if folks are actually willing to work on this.
Well, Mr. Chair,
okay. Because I'd like to help these folks out.
Two other people want to make brief comments, and Senator Roebling's been patiently waiting, so I'm going to call on Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just going to say, as far as a fiscal note, if they don't get this, they probably just don't hold their tournaments. I think of the little sportsmen's clubs around my area, and they only have like 35, 40 members, and it does say it's just for their own members that would be the exemption. And they don't want to get too complicated. And so I don't know how many of them actually would hold tournaments and pay fees. But Senator Anderson points out 120 is not a huge amount. But I just think that when it's for their own members, and maybe we could put a cap on the membership, even say something like 50 member group or less, something small that wouldn't have us growing into these great big tournaments that we sometimes see.
Hey, members, Senator Fishbach is going to withdraw the amendment, but if there are brief comments before that, Senator Olson, then I'm going to call on Senator Chaudhry. Yeah,
well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Fishbach, if these groups are small, I mean, is the competition that important, or why don't they just get together and go fishing?
Withdraw it.
Yeah, right.
That's what they'll do.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, there may be some regulation against that we haven't been made aware of yet.
Senator Chaudhry.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Senator Fishbach, as I indicated to you earlier this session, I do think this is a broader discussion that needs to be had. Okay. The fees, the fishing contest fees are fresh. Kind of need to know how they're fleshing out and how to address maybe some of the injustices that you think. And there are, and I would tend to agree that there are probably some out there. We just didn't have time to get into that this session, particularly with the fees being so fresh. But I will commit to you in front of this committee that we will have a entire hearing. Maybe not the full 2.5 hours, but we will hear this issue and figure out how we need to make changes if necessary. And members can see
that there are various issues that
The final last comment on
I was just going to say I'd be happy to work with Senator Fischbach on this as well. So I think it's a good discussion to have.
Senator Metzen.
I'll move the bill.
Amendment's been withdrawn.
I'll move the bill as amended.
Senator Metzen has moved that Senate file 3385 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. Further discussion on that motion? There being no further discussion, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and the bill is sent to the floor.
So 3190.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
It was pulled from the
committee has before it now Senate file 3190. Senator Rest.
Do you think we were done?
And members, the documents for this bill are being distributed now. And please leave the. For those who are leaving the room, please do so quietly.
This isn't for this bill.
Is this fiscal? Oh, this is a state.
Vehicle. It makes sense to me because we're going to get a big bill.
Oh, really?
Senator Rest, welcome to the committee, but let's pause just a minute till people leave the room and close the door behind you.
He's leaving.
What's my Christmas packet? I better not forget to take that with me.
This is for the last
the symbol is one page.
Well, that is a good question. What is that?
I don't know.
What is this? Isn't this about giving blood?
Mm-hmm.
Here we have a Pappas fiscal note.
Just wait.
An amendment.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning again, members. The Senate File 3130 has become a vehicle for what I call the odds and ends bill for state government. As you know, the House File 1872, among other things, had a lot of policy initiatives in it from the House, very few from the Senate, but the agreement between the two chambers was to remove those issues from House File 1812 on a variety of policy areas that ended up being kind of odds and ends, and to bundle those bills and other bills that had perhaps passed the Senate, which is what this is, to have them available for discussion in a conference committee or by prearrangement with the House to have them before the two bodies again. So that is what Senate File 3190 is now going to become. And the committee has before it a delete-all amendment, but, of course, this is not the first committee it was heard from. So if you would like, if someone would be so kind as to offer it, then I could explain what's in it.
Senator Betzel moves approval of the adoption of the A4 amendment. Discussion on that motion? Why don't we go through the amendment?
Sure. As I indicated, the there are a variety of bills that are now part of the Senate File 3190, which was originally the blood donation bill permitting state employees to go off-site to a blood donation center and to give blood on those occasions which there were a blood center had not come to the to a work site. The first bill that is in now in the delete all amendment in 3190, if you want to look at the The summary that's that was prepared by Mr. Botter and actually is Senator Pappas's go. I'm sorry that she's left the room. And it is the a bill that that puts into place salary cap modifications and deals with the state employee equitable compensation amendments, and it had been passed and is on the floor by the state and local government committee. It changes. Oh, and she is here. But Senator Pappas, if you want to add to it, I'll just give a brief overview. It changes the compensation limits applicable to all state commissioners and a variety of other officials within state government. Within state government to the salary compensation that applies to local government employees, which is 110% of the salary of the governor, with inflation adjustments beginning in 2006, and it would require the use of a recognized system for classification analysis to attain compensation equity for all state employees. Most of the sections in Article 1 are from Senator Pappas's bill, which was Senate File 2736, and if she wishes to comment further on it, I certainly would welcome that.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that the state agencies have all said that they're going to absorb the cost within their current appropriation. It really is a situation of not being able to be competitive in the marketplace. If we can't offer at the state level salaries that are comparable to what the counties and the cities offer for talented public employees, and it also creates a compression that when the commissioner's salary is compressed, then it compresses everyone else down the ladder. So that also makes it difficult to compete for talented employees. And we're facing a huge retirement issue in the next 3 years, so we're going to be doing a lot of hiring, and we want to make sure we can get the best and the brightest.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Pappas, one of the things that concerns me is that the state has employees throughout the state. So are we averaging local units of government salaries, or are we taking them from the metro area, or what is our comparison going to be? Because the salaries of local officials in greater Minnesota are significant. I bet they're significantly less in many instances than state employees currently. So how are we reaching this figure?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, Senator Roebling, I really don't know how that works. Maybe we could ask Mr. Kajewski.
Mr. Kajewski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Roebling, that amount is...
Mr. Kajewski, if you could just identify yourself.
I'm sorry. My name is Richard Kajewski. I'm the Legislative Affairs Director with the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. I think what you're referring to is a salary head, the agency head salary maximums and being, no?
No.
Maybe you could restate your question then.
It's the other portion of the bill that has to do with changing state employees' salaries so that they're competitive with local units of government salaries. And I'm wondering how we're reaching what is an average for local government salaries.
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, the competitive piece with local government salaries is specific to the agency head language in the bill. The agency head being comparable to the local government salaries is set in statute already. The other piece for the state employees and what's how you compare those to local government, that's all done through the state's own Hay system. When they rate employees, and that's done through the entire market, I would assume that that's both in-state, out-state, and what that job class demands. Currently, most state employees, a significant number of them, are already paid according to the state's own Hay study system. There's several classes that are not paid accordingly, and this language would bring their compensation level up, at least the bottom, the minimums, up to the pay range that they're hay rated at.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Lindley.
You know, I don't like this provision. We don't have a problem in many areas where we're hiring, but we have problems in certain areas. And I think that we should be addressing specific things like IT and making their salary ranges more competitive, perhaps. But I don't know that we have to do a blanket increase to attract capable employees. I haven't heard from throughout the system that we're having a problem. I've only heard it from a very few select areas that we're having trouble. And I would rather do more of a targeted approach than the blanket approach, because it's going to cost us money we don't have.
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, the IT classes have been dealt with already. I don't believe there is a hiring or retention issue within those job classes. I would state that I think the state has approximately 1,900 different job classes, and the statute currently says that the state shall attempt to pay them according to their own compensation study system that they have. And within that, there's individuals, at least in 233 of those job classes, where the state doesn't adhere to their own study system. The reason we even brought this forward is because right now, as you may know, 30% of all state employees are eligible to retire in the next 3 years, and 50% of the remaining state employees are also eligible to retire in the following five. So that's the concern with the governor issuing an executive order to do workforce planning. That kind of prompted this, and the agency had salary limits. As you may know as well, we're dealing with people, heads of the retirement systems, that are the lowest paid in the country right now, including the State Board of Investment.
But Mr. Chair, that's my point exactly. The State Board of Investment directors probably should be paid more, but we should be able to step out of certain, categories to give, people who have special skills higher pay. When they're more in demand, we know we should have to pay more. Sometimes union schedules kind of lock you in, but that doesn't mean that we should always move in synchronization with everything at once. And Mr. Chair, this is the Finance Committee. There is a fiscal note on here, and I'm just wondering how we're compensating for it within the budget. I just think it probably isn't the right time to be doing it.
Mr. Chairman?
Chairman
Pip. Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. I was still kind of struggling to understand Senator Roebling's question because I'm not real, personally familiar with how this works. But I did want to reassure you that the governor, or if there's another appropriate appointing authority, will continue to be responsible for setting the salary limits for the positions listed, all these agency heads and executive directors. And so those salaries will vary depending on the marketplace and what the demand is. And any increase to the agency head salaries must be approved by the LCC.
For the question of this section, or Senator Roebling?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, I'm wondering when you say they will vary. So if one commissioner's or deputy commissioner's salary goes up because we have a doctor in the position, or in this case of transportation, because I was wondering about this yesterday when we said that we have to have a licensed professional engineer either in the commissioner's or a deputy commissioner's spot, I'm thinking, are they locked into a lower salary potentially than someone who is working that position who is not an appointee, who is on a regular work schedule? Could we pay that engineer who might be a deputy commissioner $140,000 and not pay other deputy commissioners that much, but because this one has special skills, we could pay that one that much? Or would that deputy commissioner have to make whatever percent less than the commissioner currently makes? I'm wondering, is this giving us more flexibility, or is this still following the same pattern that we've always had?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, the statute currently says that the agency head has to be the highest paid in the agency. So with the agency had salaries set in statute, the reason that this bill actually lifts that is to remove potentially the compression that's underneath the commissioner or agency head, executive director, what have you, and allow for those provisions that you're exactly talking about.
But Mr. Chair, could they just do it in one area? Or if, like commissioner salaries, $108,000 sure. About. So if one changes, do they all change under this? Do they all become $130,000? Or can you just raise one?
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, with the governor's approval and the LCC approval, they could just raise one. As you may be aware, the LCC raised the head of the zoo, which was done a little bit differently than what you're speaking about now. But it is possible with the governor's approval and the LCC approval, which was done with the zoo director, they could raise just one commissioner salary. But as long as there's a cap on there, they are not going to be able to raise it above that cap.
Mr. Chair, unless they come to the legislature.
Yeah.
Which we did with the zoo.
Correct.
And I just want to indicate to committee members, as the chairman knows, we have to meet for a few minutes after the committee. There's another meeting at noon relative to House File 1812. That's very important. So we're going to finish this committee hearing at 11:30 this morning. We do have a hearing set for 9 o'clock tomorrow. So, Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, I guess I don't have any specific question. I just am wondering about this delete all. There's all kinds of different things in here.
That's what I said.
And well, I know you said that, but I don't think it's appropriate. I mean, this thing covers just so many issues, and I'm wondering if these should just go by, you know, these individual bills should have just been run through the system themselves. It seems like, you know, we have...
Senator Fischbach, let me help you with that. We made a decision, and this came from the Senate, to try to take a significant number of policy items out of finance bills. Now, this was primarily the House that included a variety of provisions. There were some Senate provisions, but predominantly House provisions. Now, no rule like that is perfect. But members of the conference committee can tell you that we had Representative Carlson and I went through all of the provisions, tried to make judgment calls, and the agreement with authors was that there'd be some attempt to put together omnibus policy bills, which would then come through the policy committees and would come through, obviously, the finance committee, because there are some provisions that lend itself to the finance committee. And we've certainly done this in the past where we've had omnibus finance bills. We probably have not done it on quite such an organized basis, but Senator Chaudhry's bill prior to this was no different than Senator Rest's bill. Obviously, you have a choice as to moving to amend, voting no, whatever you'd like to do. But that's why we have put together omnibus policy bills, and that was the agreement in trying to keep the finance bill, not 100% clean, but certainly cleaner than is usually the case with the supplemental finance bill or some of the other omnibus finance bills in the regular budget year. It's something that I think has met with the approval of the governor's office in terms of trying to handle things in this fashion. So there are no promises from the administration relative to these omnibus bills, but I think they like the process we've tried to set up. But to be fair to authors who worked hard on legislation all session, this seemed to be the best approach.
And Mr. Chair, I appreciate your response, but I still think that this really kind of is pushing it with you know, all of the stuff that's in this delete all amendment. I mean, it goes from salaries to limits on judicial campaign contributions, you know, HAVA stuff. It just has, you know, on the lawful gambling section, there's stuff about what the commissioner will allow use of, what kind of medications.
Chairman.
A lot of stuff in here, and so I just wanted to make that comment. And
Mr. Chairman, as I did indicate before, this is an odds and ends bill. A number of these items, as I explained, the delete all amendment beyond this first bill of Senator Pappas's have already passed the Senate.
they're just now being regrouped, including medication provisions for the Racing Commission, which I'll get to if we can just go get through the amendment. And I, I'm sympathetic to your objection, quite frankly, but this is the method by which the leadership of both the House and the Senate, working with the governor's office, have decided to deal with these bills, particularly those that had been inserted in the in House File 1812 on the House side. And when these policy bills, and this is not the only one that will come before you as kind of an odds and ends bill, when they are conferred, those items that were in House File 1812 from the House side will be open for discussion for being included in the policy bills. It's a little bit irregular, but it, as Senator Cohen indicated, it is far more organized than having to have all kinds of policy issues inserted into an omnibus finance bill, which last year just begged for vetoes, and of course that happened. And so we are trying to avoid vetoes of the finance bill or a veto of the finance bill because there is policy language that is objectionable to the governor. It is, again, a little bit irregular, but there's nothing sinister in it or trying to be anything other than transparent as to what the agreements are, and certainly any of these provisions are up to being included or excluded by starting with this committee and on the floor of the Senate. And it may be that people don't like some of these provisions and they'll move to strike them. I am not an advocate for anything other than my own bills, except for the process that we had agreed on. So I would object to just getting something out because it's part of an odds and ends bill, as opposed to members thinking that the policy is not a good one. But Mr. Chairman, if I could, responding to your request for moving through the bill, if I could go further through the delete all amendment at this time.
Yes.
Thank you. Then in sections 4, 5, 26, and 28, that is actually Senator Clark's bill, which this committee has already acted favorably on, in Senator Cohen's Senate File 3363, and it was the Minnesota Milestones provisions. Sections 6 to 10 and 30 are a bill from Senator Jungbauer that is currently in this committee, and it was amended by the State Government Budget Division and then sent to this committee. So rather than moving it by itself, which is also not moving in the House, we invited Senator Jungbauer to have that bill as part of this one. Sections 11 to 13 are also from Senate File 3363 and was my bill on the Office of Enterprise Technology reporting requirement, which was a bill that I worked on with the OET and their staff, and which is one that they are recommending as well to include here again rather than moving it separately. Sections 16 and 19 are the parts of the bill that are the underlying bill that was heard in state and local government, amended there, and will be and was sent to the Budget Division, included in the finance bill, and then removed to become the vehicle for this bundled bill. Section 21 is from a bill, Senate File 2289, Senator Rummel, and it is in Section 21. It is a bill that, quite frankly, fell through the cracks, and we hope to find a place for it. It is a non-controversial, if you look on page 15, a non-controversial provision that certainly that simply allows nonprofits to count, this is for food shelves, to count the value of donated food to a nonprofit, that it not be included in the purposes of including the purposes of calculating their $350,000 total revenue threshold. That's been a problem, an issue for some nonprofit food shelves. Sections 23 to 25 have already been passed by the Senate. Did not have a house, did not have a home in the House. And Senator Mua's bill, making one step forward in the use of judicial selection for appellate court appointments, the same kind of merit selection committee that the governor currently is advised by. Section 29, and if the page could help me out here. Yesterday evening on Senator Erickson Roep's bill, Senator Pogamiller introduced an amendment to complete the work on the Minnesota Workers Memorial Garden State Capitol grounds, and I would direct members' attention to Section 29 in the bill. I think quite properly members objected relative to its germaneness, and Senator Pogamiller asked me if I would consider offering it in committee, in the Finance Committee today as part of this bill, and I said yes. And so it is a $65,000 appropriation to the committee, to the Commissioner of Administration, to design and construct the Workers' Memorial. There's been a lot of money that's been raised so far. There was $100,000 from the 2006 session, and about $150,000 from the federal government. I believe privately funds that have been raised, $51,000. There's $300,000 waiting, and the $65,000, as I understand it, would then complete the fundraising needed to begin construction. And I have that information from Mr. Mandel from the CAP board. Then,
Senator Rest, relative to this, what's the total cost?
As I understand, the total cost is this 300 and...
Or is that something I could take a look at while you're going through the rest of the bill?
Sure. Mm-hmm. And there is a fiscal note in your packets, Mr. Chairman. I believe it includes that as well. Mr. Mosman, is that correct? If not...
Mr. Chair and members, I did not see that in my packet. The fiscal impact to the state is clearly the $65,000 appropriation,
right?
And nothing beyond that. So I don't have the details before me on the total project costs.
Then, Mr. Chairman, where you're reviewing that, the section the Article 2 dealing with lawful gambling are bills that have already passed the Senate. One of them authorizing the use of certain medications for horse racing. This was an agency bill from the Racing Commission that modernized the standards for veterinarians as they are certifying horses as free from drugs in order to run at Canterbury. Sections 2 and 3 also were passed by the by the Senate in Senate File 2533. Senator Roebling is very familiar with this provision. She and I differ on it, and it has to do with the per se definition for gambling devices, for slot machines that are present in a public place. The law was, prior to about 16, 17 months ago, was interpreted by all to mean that if a slot machine was in a public place, the assumption was that gambling's taking place there and that is illegal. There were some challenges to the interpretation of that over the past 12, 13, 14 months, and what this does is just reinsert by clarifying the per se definition. In Article 3, it deals with elections, and first of all, the contribution limits for judicial elections. This actually probably should have been included in Senate File 2574, House File 3172. Did pass the Senate last year, establishing a $2,000 contribution limit for judicial elections. And then in Section 2 is also a Larson bill from Senate File 3649 that was amended and recommended to pass by the State Government Finance Division, and deals with the HAVA account transfer for the Secretary of State's office. Ms. Fraser is here if members have questions about that.
Mr. Chairman?
That
Sir Olson.
Section.
I was just looking at the contribution limits for the judicial office and wondered why they are all at the level of the governor and lieutenant governor running together when probably the most of them are not running statewide. I could understand that the Supreme Court and the appellate court might be at that level for contributions, but the district court judges are in a much smaller territory that they're running. Why would that not be at least as low as the constitutional officers or Senate,
Mr. Chairman
level?
And Senator Olson, this bill has passed last year. I think it was a modest step forward to have all judicial elections come under a single limit, I think Senator Larson would argue. And right now, the issue is there are no limits. There are no limits for anybody running for judicial office. And the policy position was that it was argued, well, let's just have one limit for all judges, regardless of which office they're running for. Now, I believe you make a valid point with regard to the level of office, but what we did here was put in the bill that passed the Senate.
Well, Mr. Chairman, either that or one could argue the other way, which is if they're running statewide, they have a statewide audience from which to raise funds. Mm-hmm. And if they don't, then they have less, which would mean that we really should elevate all of our legislative candidates to the same level as the governor, because we're generally raising within our own district, and you probably don't have as broad a level of interest. Either that or is it in the judicial elections, they're mostly lawyers that support that, and they've got plenty of money, so.
There you go. Uh-huh.
Connections to the money.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Foley.
You're dealing with judicial salaries, and I would only point out that, first of all, this didn't come through my committee, which I consider a gross error.
It's
election contributions.
But when I look at that, some of the judicial districts are extremely large. Granted that Hennepin and Ramsey County districts are small but compact. And if you go like I do in the 10th district in includes Washington County, County, and Sherburne and Wright, and so forth, that there's a significant number of people in there, and the fact is that you, even I, who work in the courthouse in the 10th District, don't know half of the judges that are there. So it's there's no way that that a judge can effectively run for office in those big districts.
Mr. Chairman, I know you want to wrap up, but just looking at this section, it's like, and why does the Secretary of State and the State Auditor, why are they any different than the Attorney General and the Governor? They're all running statewide. Why, since the a state Senate district is twice as big as a House district, why don't we have a higher limit? You know, and I mean, there's just like so many things here. Where do you begin?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I did. I have worked on those issues, and at this point, did not go farther than what the bill did for judicial elections, which has no limits at all. And we certainly, I think, in a maybe in a non-election year, the discussion of contribution limits might be more appropriate, like, for example, next year.
Okay, so what we're going to have to do now is lay the bill over. As I said, we've got other meetings, and I apologize, Senator Rest. We have a meeting scheduled for tomorrow at 9 o'clock, and so we can pick the bill up then. We only have a Senator Higgins bill on the agenda.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if on the delete all amendment, just to have it like we should, there are two technical amendments.
Well,
could they be
if
added
we,
now?
No, if we can do that tomorrow. Okay. Senator Fredrickson?
Procedurally, Senator Betzel had moved the adoption of this amendment. We had not taken that vote. I don't know if you want to do that or not.
Okay, I forgot. Yeah, we can move on the amendment that's in front of